Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Later in the show, Rick Yeon will take us inside a lutefisk festival he attended last week, and he'll talk with the authentic Norwegian chef who made it happen. Dr. Tom Easer will stop by to explore the perils and triumphs of well digging on the Great Plains. And we'll hear from Daryl Northberg, who is urging the Ojibwe people to embrace their language and traditions as vibrant living parts of their identity. But first, we're diving into the fascinating world of sound at the Bob Paquette Microphone Museum in Milwaukee. We'll learn how microphones have changed history from the very first call by Alexander Graham Bell to the cutting-edge technology of today with a collector whose passion has created a treasure trove for sound enthusiasts.
I'm Craig Shank.
And I'm George Drake Jr. This is Everything Sounds.
March 10th, 1876 will always be one of the most historic days in American history. It was the day that one of the most important inventions of all time was first tested by two men in Boston.
During the months that we were working together on his telegraph, Bell often spoke to me of another invention he had in his mind. It was the telephone.
That's Thomas A. Watson. And of course, he's speaking about Alexander Graham Bell in 1926. Watson was Bell's assistant, and the two of them were the first to transmit one entire sentence to each other while they were in the same building over the telephone.
Bell sat in front of the new transmitter in the back room, which I had made into a laboratory for him on the top floor of number 5 Exeter Place, Boston, and I went down the hall to the front room to listen for the results with a telephone receiver.
That's when something happened, not to the phone or the phone call, but to Bell.
As Bell was about to speak into the new instrument, a motion of his arm upset over his clothes a battered jar of acidulated water. In the excitement of the accident, Bell called out to me, "Mr. Watson, come here, I want you."
And there it was, the first sentence to ever be sent by telephone.
The big mouthpiece picked up his call for help, and I heard every word of it through the receiver at my ear. The new transmitter was better than we had expected or had dared hope.
Now phone calls happen billions of times a day across the globe. But today's show isn't about phones. It's about something associated with the phone that has fundamentally changed the world. And it's something that people truly take for granted.
Watson even mentioned it before.
The big mouthpiece picked up his call for help.
Or as we know it today, the microphone. In modern phones, they're smaller than most insects. But think about how different life would be without the invention of the microphone. No sound in movies, no recorded music. And if you went to a concert, you would need to be silent, or the performers would need to be incredibly loud.
Without the microphone, the world would be a much different and, in a way, quieter place. And there's one guy who understands the importance of microphones probably more than anyone. He's been collecting them for over half a century, and he's also been the driving force behind a microphone museum in Milwaukee.
His name is Bob Paquette.
I'm Bob Paquette. I own Select Sound Service, where this museum's located.
And he runs the Bob Paquette Microphone Museum. He's one of those guys that has a collection and loves to talk about it with everyone that he can. It's not a bad thing. He's genuinely excited about what he collects. Although he began collecting in 1958, it wasn't until 1970 that he opened up his collection to the public.
No matter who walks through that door, he'll talk with them about his collection for as long as they want to stay. He's a super nice guy with a passion for microphones. So much so he wrote and compiled an 840-page book about the history of microphones. What began as a reference book for himself is now available for sale on the museum's website.
Just about anything I could put in here that I thought would be an interest to people collecting, because it shows all the different spec sheets. It shows a lot of things you'd never find anymore today.
He visited the research section of the local library for years, gathering information about the history of different microphones by brand, type, and country of origin.
Today, if I would have had the internet, I could have done it in about a year. You know? This is really doing a lot of digging and all kinds of stuff. You had to transpose to other medias and so on.
His fascination with microphones started when he was a kid. He quit school at 16 and got a job at a local business setting up audio equipment for rallies during the war.
Big arena shows, you know, they'd set up portable sound systems and so on.
And that's when he began to work with microphones.
And that's where I started. But I ended up working on microphones quite a bit because we would repair them. And eventually, when that company closed, they sold it to somebody else. And I ended up with an old 20s microphone that they had, a double button carbon. And then I wanted to know what everything was like before that, so it just got into that.
A few years later, he started his own sound company in the basement of his house. He kept it there for 8 years and was able to move to a bigger location, and from there, an even bigger location where he could not only display his collection, but he also expanded it.
Bob has got thousands of microphones.
Probably closer to 3,000.
But there are some that he's missing from the collection. Those are shown by empty mic stands where they should sit on the shelf, which is arranged chronologically and by manufacturer.
And I built, my office became shelves, and I started showing it from then on. Then it just kept getting bigger and bigger. When I bought this place, I built this room, and then just kept adding on, going backwards. So it gets bigger and bigger every year. But live another 10 years, you'll come back and interview me again.
Before we go any further talking about his collection, we want to clear something up about how microphones actually work.
Bob agrees that one common misconception that people have about microphones is that they're essentially an electric version of the human ear. That's not entirely accurate. They do pick up sounds, but the human ear has some special skills.
You know, a lot of people would call us and they'd say, just bought a big Ampex recording system and the mics are no good. Can you rent us mics? I says, it's not the mics. I says, my guess is you got 12 people at a table and you got one mic in the middle. She says, yeah. I said, it doesn't work that way.
The main difference is that the human ear is selective. With our ears, we're able to hear sounds from numerous sources and exclude different elements that we don't want to hear in order to focus on one thing. A microphone can't do that.
Let's say a microphone and a girl were having a conversation across the table at a restaurant. The microphone wouldn't be able to pinpoint only what it wants to record. The girl will blend in with the rest of the sounds in the environment. But as humans, we're able to focus in on one element, her voice in this instance, and just kind of tone down all the other sounds in the restaurant.
Absolutely nothing. Get into plank, hold it for a minute and a half, and he looked at me with a stink eye, and I said, that's right, I'm the teacher.
You try putting it on mono on earphones and listening, you can't tell. You can't separate them at all. Because just the way sound works, you know.
Around the time that microphones first started being used regularly for performances and speeches, such as presidential addresses, the technology wasn't quite what it is today. The president wouldn't have just one or two microphones at the podium like we usually see now.
It used to be they were just loaded. Everybody clip-on microphones and it looked like a mess.
They made something new. One stand with six microphones positioned in a long horizontal line.
Back in 25, was this? Yeah. Coolidge gave a talk, but they gave every group there, the networks and so on, one of the mics, and then they just had a feed to it, and they'd plug it into their system for recording.
Bob doesn't have an original, but he did make his own replica.
So I made a replica of that because that was one of the first things they ever did to try to clean up the mess.
When microphones were still a reasonably new technology, performers were a bit uncomfortable being near them. When a lounge singer would step up to the piano, they wouldn't touch the mic, let alone come close to it.
People were afraid to get up close to the mic. And typically, this is a double button carbon mic. Now, what they do is there's carbon grains in those cups. And when this is just sitting idle, it kind of sounds like in the background, real slow hiss.
There was a widespread fear concerning the dangers of electricity in the late 1800s and early 1900s due to its use in executions.
And you'd hear about people being electrocuted in the penitentiaries and so on, and electricity was dangerous if you didn't know something about it.
When people would step up onto the stage, they wouldn't be standing in front of a mic. They'd be standing in front of a mic with a lampshade on it.
They would tell the people, go by the piano and sing towards the lampshade. You can get any, you know, in 1920 when those came out, and you'd always use them in pairs, you know, for redundancy in case one quit working. And this is about as close as you can get anybody to go near that. They see three wires hanging off of each one of those, and they wouldn't go near it. And that's what those are. Those are housings, too, so that they don't see the microphone. They don't feel like there's a problem, you know.
Not only were microphones perceived to be dangerous, they were also enormous. Decorations were sometimes added to make them a bit more appealing, or depending on where they were going to be used, sometimes they'd hide them entirely. One of the things that stands out most in Bob's museum is a large candelabra in the middle of the room.
That's a funeral home, Mike.
That's right, a hidden microphone for a funeral home.
Well, when they would do the real big, say the mayor died in the city, they'd rent an auditorium. And usually there was a platform that's maybe 3 feet up. Well, that would sit in front of the platform, and they'd have a podium, so that would come up in front of them. And in fact, that's how Turner started. They were in the funeral home business, and they developed the sound system for funeral homes.
Later, Bob found out that the funeral mic was actually part of a set. And if you're a bit squeamish about morose anecdotes, now might be a good time to turn the show down for about 25 seconds, starting now.
There was a big collector in Chicago, Ralph Muckow, Dr. Muckow. He had a big radio collection. He came here one day and he saw that. He says, "You want the matching unit to that?" And I said, "What's a matching unit?" He says, "Looks just like it, only there's a fan instead of a mic, and they put in the coffin in the summer to blow flies off." And I said, "No, that's a little morbid for me. I don't need that."
Out of the thousands of microphones he has and has seen, there's a kind of microphone which Bob has never been able to track down or even find online. Microphones that have rarely been photographed, known as the Turner Color Tones. From what Craig and I know, they came in a variety of colors, including yellow, green, and orange. The design is pretty unique, kind of an Art Deco look, a large fin which goes from the bottom to the top, and it's just kind of weird looking. At the time, they were incredibly unpopular. But from a present-day audio nerd perspective, they're pretty cool.
The only ones that got those were the reps that went out in the field. There's only two or three that got a set to show people. Nobody liked them. They thought they were cheesy and crummy looking. And I called the guy probably 30 years after he designed and built these, the engineer, and he said, "Oh God, I thought this was over." He designed this and they just didn't buy them. So he took them all home, threw them in the river behind his house in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And I doubt if there's more than two or three sets of these anywhere.
Naturally, with a collection as comprehensive as Bob's, he gets a lot of offers for certain microphones and collectors looking to trade. However, he's not keen on parting with pieces of his collection.
I don't sell any mics out of the collection, no. But I do have spare mics occasionally I will sell, but the better ones I hang on to for trading stock, you know. And I've got some pretty good mics a lot of people would like. And I said, "Well, you find this one and you make an even trade for it, you know." And it's probably worth less than what I'm offering them, but I've never found it, so it's worth it to me.
Not only that, if you ask him if he'll loan one of his mics, even for a fee, he'll probably say no to that too. He does have some extra microphones that he'll rent out, but nothing from his permanent collection will leave the museum. He once had a bad experience with loaning pieces of his collection.
We'll avoid using the guy's name just to be on the safe side, but Bob would probably be willing to let you know about it if you asked him in person. Just know, he's a very famous and well-respected movie director.
I rented him some mics and he wouldn't give them back. He said, "Well, you said they're worth this much more, let me pay you for them." I said, "No, I don't want the money." I said, "I want the mics back because they're too hard to find." Well, we went around for a year or so, and then I thought, well, if I try to fight them, the only people that are going to make money are the lawyers, so I sold them for that. But it took me about 8-9 years to find the ones I had rented them, because it was like 16 mics.
While making the movie, he wanted the sounds of the microphones to match the recordings from the era that they were made. However, the mics actually sound fine. It was the radio, recording, and home audio equipment and their fidelity issues before the 1940s that people associate with the period of recordings.
And he, at the time, wanted microphones of that era. And I said, "Well, you got this mixed up. All the stuff I'm giving you is pretty high-quality stuff." And I said, "We were way ahead of the game back in the 20s and 30s. So I said, they're not going to sound like you think." He said he wanted all that, you know, all the distortion and noise and everything. But he had to hire an acoustical engineer to do that for him and EQ everything and add noise and so on, you know.
We thought it would be fun to test Bob's knowledge with something that Craig had at home. He brought in a mic that he owns to learn more about it.
This is actually a gift I got for Christmas a few years ago from my dad. Mm-hmm. He knew that I loved radio, and then it was a little bit after I'd started. So I'm just kind of curious if you know a little bit about it, you know, kind of.
In the first place, you're on a telephone base. Yeah. This belongs on a, there's another piece that goes under here that's felt lined, and it's from a telephone, a candlestick telephone. But this is a crystal microphone. Have you used it at all?
No, I've never used it.
It'll be high impedance, so you have to plug it into like a guitar amp or something, because nobody has high impedance anymore.
So I asked him when it was made.
I'd say in the 40s, probably. 40s or later 40s, yeah.
I then asked if he had one like it in his collection, and without missing a beat, he responded.
Should be right up at the top shelf there. Look along the top shelf somewhere.
Oh, yeah, right there.
See if it matches up, yeah. Pretty much exactly the same.
A room full of over 1,000 microphones, and he knows exactly where each one is.
Then he said the words George and I didn't expect to hear.
Let's go check it, see if it works.
So he walked out to his workbench, which was covered in tools and microphone parts with a wall full of cables, and we watched him essentially hotwire the mic to see if it worked.
Hello, hello. Testing 1, 2. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, hello.
That works.
I have to admit, it was pretty cool hearing my mic work for the first time. I've had it for a few years, but never actually plugged it in to test it out or record anything.
That was until we got home. Remember when Bob said that the old mics sound good, but the recordings aren't the greatest? Well, here's Craig on a digital recorder he bought in 2006.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Hello, my name is Craig.
And here he is on his old mic.
All right. Hello.
And here's Craig again. Modern Craig, that is.
Yep, it's me on a modern microphone.
And here's Craig from the 1950s.
I feel like I should be singing the Chattanooga choo-choo into this thing.
Sure, there's a little hiss and the sound is a bit tinnier than his new microphone is, but still, it's pretty good.
I found out that a lot of blues harmonica players like this type of microphone because it emphasizes certain frequencies and makes their performances sound a little bit more dirty. And to think that it was made in the 1950s, a time when the United States was impacted by racial segregation, the Red Scare, and the Korean War, but was nonetheless thriving with technology and forethought as we looked to the sky and began our exploration of space. In Latin, microphone literally translates to small sound, which is not only incorrect, but seems to not give it enough credit. The microphone is truly one of the cornerstones of media, and we have more to thank it for than simply entertainment. Without the microphone, Roosevelt never would have been able to give his fireside chats. Bell would never have been able to call Watson in March of 1876. And of course, George and I wouldn't be sharing any of this with you today.
The Bob Paquette Microphone Museum isn't just a display of antiquated technology. It's a time capsule that documents the stages of technological progress, but it's also a place to learn where everything we've grown accustomed to originates from. Every model of microphone on display has a story, and it played some role in our shared cultural history. And Bob himself? Well, he's the curator and the genius behind an outstanding collection. There are collectors, and then there are guys like Bob. He doesn't just collect, he's more of a scholar when it comes to microphones. He just wants to share that appreciation, knowledge, and passion with the world and enjoys being able to see people's faces light up as they look at his thousands of microphones. Who knew that just down the road from central Milwaukee, there's a kind man with a one-of-a-kind museum?
I still look at it like I've always been. I'm just a regular guy, and that's it. And, you know, I have a lot of information, and that's fine. I can help people out with it, but I don't look any beyond that. So it's a lot of people, when they get a hold of me finally, they'll say, well, you're the guru on microphones, I hear. Can you tell me about this? You know, so I probably got that reputation across the country. But it wasn't designed to be that way. I just enjoy doing it, and I'd like to see people learn about it, you know. Because that was the first thing I liked about the whole business, too, was the microphones and how they worked and what they did and so on.
You can learn more about Bob Paquette and his microphone museum from our website, everythingsounds.org. There you can also see pictures that we took at the museum, as well as information about where and how to buy his book, The History and Evolution of the Microphone.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dr. Tom Ezern stops by the Main Street studio for another of his Plainsfolk essays. Today, he'll shed light on the arduous and perilous efforts of early settlers to secure water on the Great Plains.
In his nifty new history of the Homestead Act, Richard Edwards says the three perils of homesteading on the Great Plains were grasshoppers, prairie fires, and childbirth. And good on him for recognizing the third of these as the most perilous of all. Earlier historians of homesteading were so focused on the masculine aspects of their subject, they neglected the obvious. Edwards goes on to outline numerous other difficulties of settlement at the grassroots, pointing out that whereas we think of land as the crucial criterion for successful settlement, water was just as essential. Finding a dependable supply of good water seemed like a never-ending task, Edwards says, which created a mentality of water scarcity. Living water, that is, a running stream that persisted through the summer, was a fair solution, but not a common one. Across the middle of North Dakota, many relied on sloughs, or prairie lakes, as we prefer to call them today. But if you've ever waded a slough in late summer and come down with a case of the prairie itch, then you know why a slough was an unsatisfactory source for potable water. Edwards concludes, homesteaders found the best answer was having a well. Which was not a simple solution, however, because in the 19th century, most all household wells were hand-dug, either by the settler himself or by a professional, and I use the term professional loosely. Actually, it took more than one person to do the job. One man worked in the hole, perhaps 6 feet in diameter, tight space, dim light, getting dimmer as he went deeper. There he filled a bucket with earth, which his partner on the surface drew up with a rope and emptied, then returned to the digger down below. The walls were curbed with stone in the process, and not uncommonly the bucket going up or down knocked a stone loose to fall on the poor digger. The digger descended into the earth and was drawn back up with the bucket, which meant there had to be a windlass mounted on top. Riding the bucket up or down was fraught with peril, but worse was the threat of foul air, as they said, coal gas, or the damps, methane, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, or hydrogen sulfide, all gases heavier than air and thus liable to accumulate down below and overcome the well digger. Probably the most famous accident to befall a well-digging homesteader was the one suffered by Jules Sandoz, as recounted by his daughter, Mari, in her biography of old Jules. Jules was down in the hole filling the bucket and had two Swedes helping him up above. Their pranks were bad enough, but worse, they let Jules down with a frayed rope. It snapped, he plummeted, and the result was two broken ankles. They hauled the tough old locator from his Nebraska claim to Fort Robinson, there to be treated by none other than the famous physician Walter Reed. Dr. Reed proposed to amputate. Hules, always ready to resort to firepower, threatened to shoot him if he tried. Against all apparent odds, he recovered. Just this past Sunday, a Lutheran sermon reminded me how many biblical narratives and dialogues are centered on hand-dug wells. There are great examples in Greece dating from the 7th century B.C. Ancient Roman engineers carried well-digging technology into North Africa and Britain. Hand-dug wells, thus, were fixtures from colonial times in America and, as we shall see, on North Dakota homesteads in the 19th century.
That was our longtime friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. After the break, Rick Yon and Prairie Plates plus Daryl Northbird is challenging the Ojibwe community to embrace their traditions and language as vibrant, living parts of their identity. That's after this.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's our music. We know what time it is. It's Wednesday, and it's time for another edition of Prairie Plates right here on Prairie Public with our great food critic, Rick Guillon. Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing well. Rick, do you consider yourself a critic? Did I get that right? Or are you a connoisseur?
I would use the word enthusiast. That's kind of what I've been using. I know too many people in the restaurant industry to be a critic, I think. So I use enthusiast, and I try not to be overly critical of things and try to be more of a cheerleader for the local restaurant scene and local food scene. So that's kind of more my scene, I guess.
No, I think that's great. And quite honestly, all of the experiences that my wife and I have had since we moved here have been great. There's been nothing to criticize. So I think food enthusiast, I'll try to remember that. Sounds really good to me. Rick, you had a chance last Friday night to visit the Sons of Norway. There was a lutefisk festival happening, and you had an interview with Chef Espen Tomta. I hope I pronounced his name correctly, from Lillehammer, Norway. Let's listen to that, and then we'll chat about it here on the backside.
I'm here with Espen Tomta from Lillehammer, Norway, who is the chef here tonight making a bunch of lutefisk here at the Sons of Norway in downtown Fargo. Espen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Just explain a little bit, what are you cooking up here tonight?
So tonight we're going to cook lutefisk the Norwegian traditional way. Because down here I know that you serve it with meatballs. And that's kind of a different way than we do it at home in Norway. So tonight it's all about how we do it in Norway.
That's really cool. How much lutefisk are you going to be serving tonight, if you can just give us an approximate number?
Oh, so I always have to convert it into pounds, but we use like a lot. We're going to have 170 people here tonight, so it's like...
Metric system's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's around 100 kilos.
Wow, that is a lot of lutefisk. And was that all caught in Norway?
This one, the fish is actually coming from the Olsen Fish Company.
Ah, yeah. Yes.
So they're making it for us, and they buy some from Norway as well.
We're very familiar with that. Tell us a little more what's on the menu. I noticed like mashed peas and something with bacon, and anything with bacon is quite good. So
that's true. So the traditional way to serve it in Norway, we have the lutefisk, which we serve with mashed peas. And we also have fingling potatoes, and of course bacon, because everything tastes better with bacon. And we also use like lefse, and for those who doesn't know what lefse is, it's like a thin potato tortilla. And then butter and mustard, and we also have the Norwegian brown cheese, which is a goat cheese, which is a little like a caramelized cheese, so we get a little sweetness to it.
And it's pronounced Gjetost?
Yeah, in Norway we call it Brunost, which is brown cheese, or Gjetost, which is goat cheese.
Gotcha. Do you actually like lutefisk?
The first time I had it, I thought it was really, really bad. The second time I had it, I thought it was really, really bad. But now, I love it. And it all depends on the quality of the fish, because there are some producers who make the cheap ones, which isn't that good. And when you talk about lutefisk, it's all about the good quality fish.
You gotta have high quality.
And when you do that, it's an amazing dish. Yeah.
What do you think is the best way to cook lutefisk?
Well, I think it's the best way to do it for me is like I take it out and I put a lot of salt on it, and it's like when you think you have enough salt, then double the amount, then you have enough. Let it sit for one or two hours in room temperature, and then we bake it on 375 Fahrenheit for about 20 minutes.
Interesting, because I've seen a lot of the recipes around here where it's basically poached for a half an hour and then it turns into gel, basically. Yeah. And then would you say it's better with butter? I think it is, but that's kind of what helps to me.
Yeah, you can poach it. In Norway, we also have these steam ovens, which is actually pretty good way to do it as well. But it's like you don't need or you can't overcook it, because then it can turn into the jelly one, and you want it like firm and flaky, like actually a normal cod. Yeah.
Last question, what do you think of being in Fargo and being a part of this Lutefisk Festival?
Well, for me, it's an honor to just be able to come down here. And I've always loved America, so I've been here once before. So for me, it's like, this is just fun all over. And Fargo is, yeah, it's an amazing city.
Espen, thanks for joining us today.
That sounded like it was really a fun night.
Yes, Chef Espen Tomta from Lillehammer, Norway, and served about 170 people. The room was packed. The tickets sold out to this event, this Lutefisk Festival, or they called it the Lutefisk Festivalen at the Sons of Norway in downtown Fargo. And he cooked up, he said, around 100 kilos of lutefisk, but that equals out to about 220 pounds of lutefisk, which is codfish that they catch in Norway. And then it's processed partly in Norway and then goes to Minneapolis. And then the lute happens, the part where they soak it in lye and that sort of thing. You know, it doesn't sound very good, but after they pull the lye out and... Chef Espen used a technique in Norway. This was the way they traditionally cook it in Norway. They roasted it, or baked it, you could say, at 375 degrees Fahrenheit instead of poaching it for, in my opinion, far too long when it turns into a jelly-like substance and you have to put a bunch of melted butter on it to make it good. Instead, Chef Tomta roasted it 375, all of it, and I thought it tasted like regular cod. It was quite good. And then he served it with bacon, cut up bacon, chopped up bacon with the liquid bacon fat. I like butter with it. I mean, butter is just good, especially with seafood and stuff like that. But the bacon made it. And for those that like lutefisk, I would try it with chopped up bacon. Save some of that liquid bacon fat and put that on there. This is the way it's traditionally served. Just a little tip for you. And I think the Sons of Norway may go this route. So it's kind of an interesting take on it.
Have you ever had it, Rick, and just not liked it? Like, he didn't like his first cracks at it until maybe he got a little maybe better at preparing it?
Oh, absolutely. When it's overcooked and it turns into this jelly-like substance, it doesn't really, to me, seem like fish anymore. It's kind of in a different form. And so when I was a kid, I tried it a few times and I did not like it. And I've had it at the Sons of Norway a few times, and they serve it with meatballs, which is not traditional in Norway, but I do like meatballs a lot. And they do a good job over at the Sons of Norway at some of the church basement type dinners. But yeah, I mean, I've tried it a few times and I didn't try it again for about, 20 years.
Did it surprise you, Rick, that Chef Tomta had only been in the United States just, what was it, once before? This was his second trip here?
Yeah, and he did a dinner in Minneapolis, I believe, the time before, and he does these in Norway quite a bit, and then he'll serve them with fingerling potatoes, mushy peas, lefse, and at the Sons of Norway, it's homemade lefse with Geitost cheese, which is kind of a caramelized goat cheese, and for those Norwegian food aficionados, you are very familiar with that cheese, but really a traditional feel, and he does this during holiday time in Norway, and then they invited him, I think, to a Sons of Norway in Minneapolis or something affiliated, and then after that, he came up here, so it's really kind of interesting, and we hope to see more of him here. He was really a hit. He went out and talked with people in the crowd and made a lot of friends that night and may or may not have had some aquavit too, which is which is kind of a spicy Norwegian liqueur, or just kind of, it's like Norwegian gin in a way. It's made with like fennel, star anise, certain things like that. But he made a lot of friends that night, not only with his food, he's just a friendly guy.
Is there any dish at all that relates to lutefisk in your mind, Rick, that's somewhat similar but different?
A lot of, like, Italian culture, Spanish, Portuguese, there's bacalao, and it's a dried salted cod. The first step, well, in in making lutefisk is catching the fish, but the second step is drying it. And with lutefisk, they don't salt it and dry it. It's just dried. But in these other cultures, Italy, Portugal, Spain, it's dried and salted and reconstituted, oftentimes soaked in a little bit of milk too, just to kind of help bring down the fishy flavor and get the salt out. This process with the lute is different, but kind of the same, because they're preserving this fish. It comes out of a history of preservation of people not being able to catch this fish. And so they want to preserve it. And then, you know, it probably in modern day times, it's not really that necessary to do all this preservation. But I think just over history, it's just something that's very significant to these three countries, and probably more than I know about, but those are the three that I, or four that I know of.
I chuckled with his comment, use as much salt as you need and then double it. And I'm thinking, okay, if you have high blood pressure, this may not be your jam.
And he's right, since the fish isn't salted, it does need quite a bit of salt. And I like to roast cod at home. I do it with kind of a shallot, garlic, butter, olive oil, scallion sauce, and I just cook it for like 10 minutes. Once it starts flaking, it's out. And so cooking this stuff, they like to cook it for a while, and I was wondering if it's going to turn into rubber when they're roasting it for like 25 minutes or whatever, but it was actually quite good.
Rick Gion joins us each and every Wednesday here on Main Street. He hosts Prairie Plates. Rick, thanks again for joining us.
You bet. Good to be with you, Craig.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra continues its season Dreamscapes with Christmas Dreams on November 18th and 19th at the Belmehus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Versatile artists Michael Cartwright and Cindy McQuillan Grace join the Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra for a collection of holiday favorites. More information and tickets can be found online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Daryl Northbird wishes to challenge the way Ojibwe people are thinking and encourages them not to look at their language and tradition as museum culture or museum language, but to go home and practice, to learn and understand their traditions, culture, and language.
So this is Nabik, and I'm gonna talk about some things to give you some food for thought as Anishinaabe people and our non-Anishinaabe relatives that might be hearing this, to help you all kind of broaden your thinking as cultural issues as an Anishinaabe person kind of come about. They come back and forth. So Nongo Midashane Witashindanwe, museum language, museum culture, as I guess I call it that. So one of the things, you know, in regard to our language that I'm starting to see more and more of, and maybe it's always been this way, I'm not sure, that the times that we wish to appear Anishinaabe, like if we're writing a grant or we're making an organization, we tend to want to put our language as the title, and which is a good thing. I think those things are good. I think it really helps the rest of the world realize and understand we as Ojibwe Anishinaabe people are still here, and we still have something to say to the world that could be helpful. So what I want to address today, and perhaps all of these presentations that I've been doing, is to talk about getting deeper than just the surface of our culture. So one of the things that I run into a lot, I have as a more, you know, semi-advanced language learner, I have a lot of people, they'll text me or message me and they're asking questions about how they can call a certain grant. And, you know, it's really interesting to see what it is that they're trying to say. Oftentimes when we look deeper at some of the programming and grants that we're writing, the Anishinaabe name is the only thing
that would resemble Anishinaabe thought in the things that we're developing. And through no fault of our own, I'm not trying to cast shadows or dispersion on anyone that's trying to create systems to improve our situation as Anishinaabe people. That's not my intent here whatsoever. I do, however, want to challenge those of us that are creating these systems. Are we doing these with Anishinaabe ways of doing? Is that central to what we're doing, our Anishinaabe ways of thinking about things? So oftentimes we'll say, well, you know, we're Anishinaabe people. How can it not be? But then when we look at the systems and some of the programs perhaps that we put together, they're run like colonizer operations. And very rarely, you know, do we see actual Anishinaabe ways of doings being incorporated into the way we're educating our children or the way we're healing different folks, whether it's in the hospital or it's in a mental health office. How often, you know, do the practitioners of these things have understanding of our ways of doing, our ways of healing, the preemptive nature of our teachings? And if they're devoid of that, and again, I want to be careful. I don't want to, you know, cast dispersions on people that have went to college and done very well and, you know, got their degree, and that all those things are good. They're good things and they're needed. But when I had an opportunity years ago to talk to a high school graduating class over in White Earth, and one of the things I told them is like, this is really good what you accomplished. It's really good. Now, take some time to go home and learn about your teachings. Learn about your Anishinaabe ways of thinking and doing. Because those two things melded together can be a powerful tool. So when I use the phrase museum language, I think about the use of our language where, you know, people are calling me and they want to put a label on a grant or an organization, but they don't have that understanding themselves, and no one in the organization has enough understanding to be able to create that name. So, and one of my aunties, I heard her do a presentation at BSU one time at Bemidji State University, and I heard her say the phrase, if you don't have the word, can you think the thought? And that had such an impact on me, and understanding that if we don't understand our language and we don't understand ourselves as Anishinaabe people within the context of the language that we're given, then what do we actually have? And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but the one of the things I'm afraid of is that the only time we engage with our language is we want to appear to the colonizers as distinct Anishinaabe people. There's nothing wrong with that. But I want to encourage people to go deeper, to look at, is the way I'm writing this grant, would that make our ancestors proud? Are we utilizing the teachings that our ancestors suffered to keep on this earth? And so when we talk about how do we use culture in this modern world, again, that's the kind of theme of all these presentations that I'm doing. In order to use that culture, we have to have that deeper understanding. So my encouragement is, don't just use language to label stuff. Our language is rich and it is full of knowledge. It is full of understandings about how we are to interact with the world around us, how we are to acknowledge the powers that be, how it is that, you know, anything, any aspect of our lives, there are teachings within the language to help us navigate and stay closer to who our ancestors were and who we were perhaps designed to be. And the reason why I think that's important, because as Ojibwe Anishinaabe people, we have a unique understanding of the world around us, and perhaps unique remedies to some of the things that ail the world around us. As we watch big industry destroy the physical world, destroy the economies around the world, brutalizing many of them, to understand the idea of true respect for the all of the beings here on earth, seen and unseen. And I believe that as Anishinaabe people, you know, we are a heart people, and we're living in a society that does not reward the heart and people that are that utilize their heart to navigate this world. This world right now rewards those that think with their brain, the intellect. And so the heart gets pushed to the back. And us as Anishinaabe people, that's who we are. That's why this world is so difficult at times. And we have to compromise our true being so we can fit in and be able to have some sort of comfort in this world. So when we talk about the idea of using language and making sure that we go deeper into it, glean the meaning of language and the teachings therein. So this little bit I wanted to talk about, let's not be museum language users and just labeling things that are otherwise, in all other aspects, colonizer thinking, but to challenge ourselves to utilize that language to springboard us into a world that our ancestors would be proud of. Just food for thought.
That was Daryl Northbird from the program called Living the Ojibwe Way of Life. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 20th. On this date, in 1909, Professor Benjamin Shambaugh, a professor at the University of Iowa, delivered a convocation speech at the University of North Dakota titled The History of the West. According to the Student, UND student newspaper, Shambaugh defined the West not as a geographical area, but as a state of mind. The Student reported that Shambaugh said, "The West is where a man is. The East is where his father came from. Columbus was the first great Westerner. The explorers, the colonists, and the pioneers who followed him were all broad-minded men with a vision. Each was a true Westerner." Shambaugh explained that in the early days of America, the frontier was very close to the Atlantic coast. However, after the Revolution, it gradually pushed farther westward, and this movement continued until the entire continent was settled. Professor Shambaugh viewed the American story as a pioneer epic, stating that the ancestors of our American pioneers were Aryans, and those of the Great Central West were mainly Anglo-Saxons. The Student also reported him saying, "Though the farthest limits of the continent have been reached, and all of the lands occupied, the West is not all conquered. The West is a state of mind. The frontier is a condition." In Shambaugh's view, the American West was not a physical place, but a state of continuous conquest, where new challenges were always to be met and grappled with. His ideology reflected the thinking of his time, aligning with Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier thesis and prefiguring Henry Luce's American Century, 1941 essay in Life magazine that promoted internationalism. Professor Shambaugh holds an esteemed reputation at the University of Iowa. His home is a revered spot on campus, and an auditorium is named in his honor. As the founding chair of its Department of Political Science, he significantly raised the profile of the State Historical Society of Iowa, which he managed as its superintendent. While Shambaugh's ideas would be considered controversial today, his concept of perpetual conquest has played a key role in shaping American identity. Today's a Dakota Datebook, written by Andrew Alexis Farvel. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thanks for spending part of your day with us here on member-supported Prairie Public. Tomorrow on the show, Matt Olien reviews the movie A Real Pain. It's a film about two cousins who explore their late grandmother's Holocaust history in Poland. Plus, we'll talk with retail technology expert Adam Dumay. It's all happening tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.